Welcome, everybody, to Season 10 of Underserved, episode number 113. Joining me today in studio is Rob Salvador, CEO of DigiBuild. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Rob, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Happy to be here, Andrew. Thanks for having me and excited to get into it.
So back in the early 2000s, your tech focus was mostly around being an online poker player. What was that like?
I grew up in the south suburbs of Chicago, and you know, throughout high school, right in high school and early college for me was the big poker boom. If you remember, kind of early 2000s, Full Tilt Poker, Poker Stars, it was all over ESPN, and there was a big hype around it. I was one of those, I guess you'd call, nerds that would play, you know, 10, 12 rooms at a time, made good money off of it, obviously learned a lot. Back then, it was very much thought of, Texas Hold'em poker was thought as a game of skill, incorporates game theory and psychology and reading people and, you know, bankroll management and things like that. So it was a great experience. I thought that was going to be my life, you know, for a long time. There was good careers, people making, you know, good careers doing that. But unfortunately, I was playing online. I wasn't going to the casinos. And then one day, the Department of Justice shut down poker. It was a big deal. It was called Black Friday in poker, and all of our money was frozen. My future life, or so I thought, was definitely stopped. And it was a tough time for a couple of years because a lot of people who, you know, were making careers out of that were having the rug taken out from under them.
Few questions about your online career. You're multi-tabling. You're playing tons of them at once. Are you playing no limit all the time? Are you playing limit? Do you have any other games besides Hold'em you're playing?
Yeah, I was playing No Limit Texas Hold'em most of the time. Omaha started to get popular because it had a bunch more variants and people could either make or lose a bunch of money. But No Limit Texas Hold'em was what I focused on, mostly multi-table tournaments. There was two sides back then, the cash game players and the tournament players. The tournament players thought they were better. The cash game players thought they were better. The cash game players were probably better. But yeah, I was part of the big group playing No Limit Texas Hold'em.
What was a memorable tournament win you had?
I used to drive my family crazy because I would have the poker chips next to me at the computer and I could shuffle them and do all these tricks, but it was super loud. It was like plastic grinding together nonstop. So I used to always get in trouble for, you know, playing with the chips. But then one night I was in a $11 buy-in, 5,000 person tournament and ended up winning that. So I remember just yelling that night at like 2 a.m. when I won it. And then that wasn't bad enough. I then did like a fake interview where like my mom came down like, why were you yelling? And I was talking to the wall pretending I was doing an interview for my victory. So needless to say, I've been a nerd for a long time. Even to this day, I think I tell people all the time, the lessons I learned, and I'm sure you know would agree with this, the things you learn in poker really do translate to the business world and, you know, many different places in success. You see a lot of people who were really good at poker ended up being big business people, or they got involved in tech or even crypto. So definitely learned a lot from it. And I'm grateful for having done that.
As long as you can keep the sickness to a minimum.
Yeah. I mean, being on tilt is as bad as it gets. But again, same thing. Running a business, I mean, so much of emotional control and emotional intelligence, I think I probably learned from, you know, a tournament where I was top five and then out of nowhere, you take a bad beat and you're gone. And if you don't learn how to deal with that, it can be difficult. So yeah, it's definitely helped in my later stages in life.
So Black Friday happens. The Department of Justice puts a damper on everyone's party. I mean, some folks have millions of dollars tied up there. What do you move on to from there?
From there, it was really confusing because for a while we had no idea, you know, if we were going to get our money. So then I was still in school. So I still had the proverbial road in front of me, but I was working for a construction company at the time. So I went back, you know, to working as a project manager in a construction office, going to school, but it was never really quite the same. And kind of, I think even then I started thinking about like, what am I going to do that's bigger than this? You know, the standard education grind or corporate world just didn't seem that intriguing to me. So did construction for a few years after that.
Is this when you were working with your dad?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
So my dad's always had some small company. He's, you know, even since I was a kid, he was a drywall contractor, but he kind of came from an area, you know, grew up in a bad area, never really got an education. He had to drop out of high school to work, you know, to make money for his family. So time after time throughout the years, I watched him, you know, have a good opportunity and then just blow it up with, you know, bad decision making and not even, you know, in a mean way. He just didn't know any better. Like he was never taught how to manage money and how to grow things and compound things. So the time I was working for him during one of the good moments, which I assume probably didn't last too long from what I remember.
Yeah, 2008 hit and everyone took a beating, including folks in the construction industry. What was that like?
Yeah, I remember watching live, I think it was it Lehman Brothers when they went under. Like, I was old enough to understand it, but not like from a financial or like a monetary perspective or like what was happening in the broader economy. But I do remember seeing the people on TV who I thought knew what they were doing, which maybe they didn't. That's another question. But I remember seeing how serious it seemed to them. And then I remember just like, in the months after that, in the year after that, the construction market was just frozen. You know, jobs didn't start. My dad lost a bunch of work. So I remember that was a really, really tough time.
So what do you do to get through that?
So, I mean, at that point, it was rough. You know, he couldn't keep me on. He didn't have much work. I was kind of lost. I was like, what am I doing? So let's say we're maybe in 2009, a couple of years after the global financial crisis where the construction real estate industry hadn't really fixed itself yet. I was desperate and I went to work at Walmart. Remember, it was the holiday season. I had no money. You know, I was in school, of course, still. But I remember being lost and kind of wondering what my purpose was. I knew I was, you know, needed to do something and I just needed some money. And I went and got a job at Walmart as a frozen food employee. And I worked really hard there. And I actually ended up learning so much, even though it was one of the worst times of my life. I was there for probably about a year. You know, I got promoted pretty quick to where I was managing the grocery section of the Walmart by a couple months in. And I remember thinking, I'm managing $50 million worth of inventory, making $10 an hour. Like, this isn't right. I'm better than this. But I also remember specifically learning, like telling myself, okay, let's learn from this. So I would go in their inventory and I'd be like, okay, how do they refill their inventory? And, you know, we had these little staff emails that I'm sure no one at Walmart really uses. I was always in that email, emailing like a district manager. Hey, can we do this deal? Can we do something? So even though it was a really tough and challenging time for me, I learned so much from it. And it really set me on a path, both understanding what big corporations and successful corporations do that make them successful, as well as the Walmart piece always being a reminder of what I don't want to go back to. And, you know, I think even to this day, it helps me, you know, focus and stay motivated.
Now, you kind of at a crossroads at this point because you got to decide, like, am I going to keep banging away at the student thing or do I want to learn by doing? For other folks that kind of end up in that situation, what would your advice be to them?
So, I mean, I think it's always good to learn by doing somewhat. If you want to start a business, you should work for a good business first, or at least see what a good business entails. That said, I think in the modern economy, like, I definitely lean more towards people having their own business and their own hustle. Even if you have a day job, there's nothing wrong with that. But I think more and more you're seeing people who are, even if you have a day job, you're investing in something or you're starting a business. I think that's why you see, you know, places like Robinhood, you know, for stock trading so popular, and even things like crypto. More and more people are realizing that it's better to have your own gig. But I also think the economy's been built in a way the last like 50 years that it's kind of forcing people to that now. 50 years of inflation and people are realizing, hey, I need to do things to kind of outpace that inflation. So I would say, you know, it's different for everyone. Owning a business, it's the hardest thing anyone will ever do. And you really have to be dedicated and obsessed with it. Some people, you know, have certain dreams that line up very well with, you know, a corporate job. You have your house and your family and your kids, and like, there's nothing more that you want. Some people have much bigger dreams than that, and either one is okay. It's just more specifically, what do you want in your life? And then make sure you really, really want it. I think a lot of people kind of want it, like, oh, I do want this, but they don't want it more than they want to go out. They don't want it more than they want to party. They don't want it more than they want to sleep in. So it really does have to be an obsession if you're going to own your own business.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Maris Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's mariscg.com.
The years of, you know, working for IBM for 50 years, getting a gold watch and a retirement and a pension are over. It's definitely more take care of yourself. They started that with the 401ks. And I agree with you that so many folks have some sort of side hustle or side investment. And I like that because you can dabble in it and you're not betting the house on it. You're not going all in.
Yeah.
And if it starts paying off and if it starts eclipsing your primary earnings, then okay, maybe it is time to change. Let it catch fire before you make the big jump.
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea of moonlighting, right? Like, you know, a big corporate might not like the idea that some of their employees have another job, or it might be in your employment agreement, whatever, and that's a separate thing. Also why they're so probably inefficient, a lot of those big companies, because they don't, you know, empower their employees to do things. But there's multiple ways that you can do it, and whatever matters to you the most. So for me, I was at Walmart. Then I was like, okay, I'm doing too much here. Opportunity opened up for Procter & Gamble, business analyst in Seattle. So I get this job, I take this job, go out there. And at that point, I was with P&G, I think 3 or 4 years. And a year or two in is when I started my construction company. So as I was out in Seattle, I was learning a lot, but I was still like, this corporate didn't do it for me. So I'm like, okay, I need to start working on something. So I started learning, watching business videos, watching construction videos about how to run construction companies. And one day I called my dad. He was down in the dumps. He just had a job go bad, had no money. I was like, listen, I'm going to take my savings. I'm going to start a company. You come work for me. You run the field and the field operations, which is what you're great at and experienced in, and I'm going to run the business, which is what I've been learning and what I'm good at. So to your point, for the first couple of years of even my construction company, which led, you know, many years later to where I am now, I was moonlighting my main job at P&G and kind of getting ready on the construction company until I was actually ready to do it. And then continued for a couple of years once the construction company started. But then P&G called me one day and was like, what is going on here? And I was like, well, I have two huge hotels going on right now. I'm a little busy. So I think it's best that I, you know, quit.
So you get your dad doing kind of the hands-on nuts and bolts part of the business, and you're working on the estimation, the back office, and all of this stuff. What does it lead to from there?
Yeah. So it was, you know, a great outcome for all of us. Over the next 10 years, we built all around the country, specialized mostly in apartments, hotels, big commercial. As I said, for the first, I think it was 2 years, I kept my P&G job. So I was really hustling at that point. I would, you know, jump from a call where I was like this unit manager with my people talking about Crest toothpaste and Tide and, you know, Bounty and all these different brands. And then I'd jump to another call where I was like, okay, let's talk about this, you know, drywall and this change order. So it was definitely a lot, but it was a great experience for me, obviously, you know, going from having nothing to like really busting my butt to have two jobs and, you know, doing well financially and having good insurance. It was, you know, really nice for me. And then tried to, you know, hold on as long as I could, but then got to the point where the construction company was getting bigger and expanding. Like I said, even early on, we had two really big hotels going. And so after about 2 years, left the P&G job just for, you know, running construction. And yeah, that was great. I learned so much from it. We managed hundreds of millions of dollars worth of projects, you know, put my dad in a position where, you know, he might not have been if we weren't able to do that. So I've always been really proud of that and happy. Even to this day, he still runs our operations. You know, we're closer than ever, eternally grateful that I got the opportunity to do that.
Who were the brands you were building the hotels for?
Oh, I mean, all of them, Marriott, Choice Hotels, dual brand hotels that were both. One of my favorite ones was a Residence Inn in Orlando, Florida, close to Universal Studios. We were there in, I think, 2017-ish. One, I secretly love Orlando and Disney and Universal and all that stuff. So I would fly down there all the time for, you know, quote unquote, job site meetings. But you know, it was probably a meeting I could have taken on the phone, and I just wanted to go to like Animal Kingdom or like one of those Disney parks. That was a great one. One, because it was a really big hotel. It was like almost a 200,000 square foot hotel in a great area. Very challenging job, and we were happy to get through it. It kind of all came full circle. About 10 months ago, though, I had my first Fox Business appearance where I went on Fox Business Mornings with Maria. And it was a remote appearance. And I was traveling at the time, as I always am. I was in Orlando. So the hotel I booked was the hotel we had built.
You're like, I built this room. No big deal.
Yeah, no biggie, right? And we were talking about AI. But, you know, the whole time I was like pointing behind me, like, you see that nice countertop? To ask me about that.
Now, you mentioned on the pre-call, though, construction is a tough business. And it's often very tough on those that choose it as practitioners. What does that mean to you? And what have you found from the people you know?
It's an industry that has a high rate of failure. 70% of projects finish late or over budget. So imagine if, you know, 70% of the time your Amazon package didn't show up or showed up really late. That's the norm in construction. It's an industry that has a lot of conflict, a lot of pressure, high intensity situations, you know, call it swearing on the job site, things like that. So those conditions also lead it to be an industry that has a very high suicide rate, second highest suicide rate in the country. And so that's something that, like, I experienced firsthand. It's very personal to me, both from my father. You know, I watched my dad throughout the years, as I said, really struggle. Like, there were times where he didn't have gas to drop me off. My parents were divorced when I was really young, so he'd pick me up on weekends. And there were times where he didn't have gas money to take me back. So it always impacted me just seeing him. I remember being at a job site downtown Chicago. I still remember to this day, I was probably 10 years old, 300 West Adams. We drove down there at 3 a.m. because he had to finish painting before the workday the next day so he could get paid. We stayed there all night, worked. I remember driving home at 5 a.m. with him. The next day, I remember waking up and hearing him talking to his wife saying they didn't get paid. So they stayed there all night for no reason. And that there's a million different reasons for that. It happens all the time. That impacted me a lot. So to your question about, you know, construction being such a tough industry, as someone who grew up in it, and also as someone who's kind of learned the tech side of things where I can impact it, not just tech, but knowing the market itself, it's a lot more than just making money. It's I actually want to make a difference for people who I've seen struggle. My co-founder for DigiBuild, the tech company, which we'll get into, her father was also in construction. And she tells me a story where she used to have to sit in her kitchen during the winter because their heat was out and the kitchen was the only warm place. So her dad struggled a lot too. And he committed suicide when she was 10 years old. Yeah. And multiple things like that really make it mean a lot to me to make a difference in the industry.
I'm sure this pushed you personally to figure out some way, how can I make this better? So how does your hands-on experience and the drive to improve it lead to DigiBuild?
Construction's very old and antiquated in the way it does things, still uses spreadsheets and phone calls and manual processes for a lot of the things that many other markets have now gone to digitization and software for. So the good news is construction, like what it needs is really simple to figure out. It needs digitization, it needs technology, it needs more efficiencies. The hard part is implementing it. So working on the builder side, the contractor side all these years, I saw the problems firsthand and just realized that software is where the world is going. So I tried to, you know, skate where the puck was going, so to speak. Just realizing some of the major problems, you know, talking to so many people in the industry, started DigiBuild about almost 6 years ago now, just based on that experience. And we still do build on the construction side, but I realized just through all that, it would be a much longer, less impactful road if I'm just building hotels and apartments and stuff, you know, kind of just getting along just to get along the way everyone else does, than it would be if I actually wanted to truly disrupt the industry using tech. So that's kind of where the idea for DigiBuild came from. Same thing we talked about before. Started as a moonlighting idea. So it'd be, you know, SLP is my construction company. It'd be SLP all day. And then about midnight, the DigiBuild paperwork would come out. You know, I had a bunch of whiteboards and stuff all over my, you know, living room. And my poor girlfriend at the time, she was like, well, what about me? I'm like, well, it's DigiBuild time now. What am I supposed to do? God bless her. She's a great friend of mine now, an amazing person. But yeah, so moonlighting at night, DigiBuild. And then after a certain time, DigiBuild, you know, started getting a lot of traction. We got venture funding, things like that. So that's when I kind of made the jump to full-time running all the tech stuff.
So what are those kind of long poles in the tent? Is it managing schedule and dependencies, subcontractors? Is it materials and ERP? Like, what are the big ones that everyone's challenged by?
Yeah, I mean, all of them that you named, just as an example of how bad construction is, all of the above and more. So there's a lot of stakeholders in construction. The market's very siloed. So on any given project, you might have 50 different companies who are not related to each other, but have to do business together. You have to buy your material from here, but then the architect here has to approve it. But then the general contractor has to approve the payment. Then the subcontractor has to do the work. So you get a lot of inefficiencies there, a lot of information that's lost in phone calls or buried in email. Supply chain and material management, which is one of the biggest pain points that we solve, is one of the biggest issues in the industry in general. These people don't have time to go out and get a bunch of different quotes. You know, they're so busy that they might get a quote for some metal that they need to use for framing a job. And they go, okay, that's great. I have it. That's all I need. Well, the smart decision there is to go get 10 metal quotes to get the lowest price and the metal that can get to you the fastest. But because that is one of a million different pieces of paperwork a project manager is dealing with, a lot of the times stuff like that just goes under the table. So yeah, we provide a lot of automation, gets them better pricing, takes away a lot of the things that suck up their bandwidth throughout the day-to-day you know, paper-laden processes, things like that, and really just helping them be more efficient with their numbers, their margins, their job schedule. So we'll use artificial intelligence to basically cross-reference the materials they need on a project with their construction schedule and tell everyone when they need to order that material by. You can imagine on a project that might have 100,000 different types of material that have to go into that building, how difficult that could be to manage all those. Oh, we need framing material today. We need the insulation today. We need the RC1 tomorrow. We need the drywall next week. In 10 months, we need the doors and the window or whatever. So using AI to do that can really clean up a lot of the inefficiencies that create those bad conditions that we've been talking about.
You mentioned a bit about your co-founder. How did you two originally meet?
Yeah, so she was an early mentor of mine. She was the one who hired me at Procter & Gamble coming out of Walmart. She's incredible at building teams and getting people to really drive forward together in a mission. So she was very impactful in my life, both from a perspective of she gave me an opportunity to grow and gave me the freedom to do that. But also she was just a hustler. Like she worked nonstop. So when I was in Seattle, I used to book a lot of her appointments and things. One time she worked for 24 hours straight, literally. She didn't sleep. And I was like, okay, whatever, that's one thing. But then had to get on a flight, fly to New York, do a presentation at 5 a.m. So she had me call her after she took a 1 hour nap in New York to wake her up so she could prepare for the meeting at 5 a.m. So I just remember being like, this person doesn't stop. And so that really was, you know, impactful to me as well. And I think that's part of the reason I really bring that type of hustle to what I do. I don't consider myself smarter than anyone. I work harder. That's my superpower. And I think April, my co-founder, really helped to instill that in me too.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh. Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Maris? They're the staffing firm with the best technical resources around. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Maris. And they put resources to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy that Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy.
Aww. That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Maris today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
So you have an idea for this. You look at some other software in the industry. How do you get like your first MVP off the ground?
Because the industry is just using spreadsheets and whatnot, it was just a matter of, you know, getting that MVP out there and starting to go to customers. We self-funded part of it. And then a couple of my investors, people I'd worked with and people who had invested in me in the construction industry, became my first investors in DigiBuild. With those funds, we were able to build the minimum viable product, get it out to some customers. Actually, funny you mentioned IBM. We actually had a little partnership with IBM where we did an innovation summit in San Francisco. So we did it at the IBM big office out there and had all these big construction companies come in. And so, yeah, from there, it's just a matter of going to your customers, talking to them, showing them the, you know, pain point that you solve and getting into that sales cycle and redoing it over and over and over again.
And so this is delivered as SaaS software?
Yeah, exactly.
What were some of your experiences kind of now having your first tech startup? How is that different than having your construction startup, if you will?
Oh, man. I thought I knew a little bit about running a business coming from construction, but like the tech world is a different world, right? And you know this, you know, there's a reason that venture-backed startups are the, like getting venture backing is the hardest business thing to do in the country. I forget what the number is. It's far less than 1% of companies that go for venture backing receive it. So build it, then COVID happens, right? So let's take the story before COVID and then I'll kind of transition to what I learned in 2024, many years later. So work with IBM, that goes, yeah, not that far. Get a couple early customers, starting to do good. Then COVID hits. And this is right as we start getting ready to raise a venture capital round. You know, at this point, we need to actually bring in some funds. You know, we've self-funded as much as we can. You know, we got that little investment. So COVID hits. And if you remember, the world went crazy, especially the financial world. I think it was March 3rd or something like that. 2020 was the biggest drop in financial history. The markets all cratered. It was insane. Because it was right after they announced the lockdowns. A good 6-8 months go by. And now everyone's realizing, hey, these lockdowns aren't going anywhere. And we're all like, holy crap, we're supposed to be going to San Francisco and New York trying to raise venture capital. Now what? Well, the world kind of transitioned to Zoom and things like that. But for a while, like the venture capital market, sophisticated venture capital was frozen. It was hard to get an investment from like a big investor. So we pivoted. We're like, okay, what can we do? What is not shut down? And I was like, well, the internet's not shut down. And like the internet's a good source of capital for people who know how to use it. And so I ended up talking to my team and saying, let's do a crowdfund. So we were in touch with Tim Draper, who's a big billionaire investor. He had this little TV show that he did where it's kind of like Shark Tank. Long story short, get in touch with him. We get invited on the show. And part of the show is you have to do a crowdfund with the show. The premise of the show is to let the viewers invest alongside Tim Draper, the big venture capitalist, right? So we ended up doing a crowdfund and we raised $1 million in 3 months from like 2,000 different investors. So it was a great lesson in, you know, you can always pivot if something isn't going the way you need to. It was also a great lesson, and most people still do not understand the power of the internet when it comes to raising capital. You have access to more people and more capital than has ever existed. So that happens. And then after that, we were on a rocket ship. So we get into Y Combinator shortly after that. For those who aren't aware, Y Combinator, kind of the premier investor for early stage tech startups. You know, they founded DoorDash and, you know, all these companies, the biggest unicorns in the world, Airbnb, all these different companies. Even then, talking about participator acceptance rate, I think YC's acceptance rate, I think in our batch, I think they said like 25,000 companies applied, and I think a couple hundred got accepted. So super honored to be trained by them, raised, you know, a $4 million seed round originally, raised a few more $1 million after that. And then from there, another big move that we made was from Chicago to Miami during COVID. That was great. During that, we donated some of our services during one of the hurricanes, Hurricane Ian. We procure building materials. So we gave a bunch of free building materials to the state of Florida and people who were trying to recover. Got to know Governor DeSantis down in Florida during that time and his team, and got pretty close to them, which kind of circles into some of the things I do now alongside the tech, which is kind of provide some consulting and tech consulting to politicians and whatnot.
You told me an interesting story on the pre-call where you got involved with the DeSantis campaign and working with them on their technology. What was that like?
It was an incredible experience to be involved in a presidential campaign just in general. So basically, when we moved to Florida, got to know his team. They appreciated what we did. It was a good story for them. Well-known tech startup moved from Chicago to Miami, blah, blah, blah. Stayed in touch. And then Hurricane Idalia last year, we donated materials again to the recovery. The governor and his team appreciated it. About 8 months ago, whenever the kickoff was, they called me in and said, hey, will you help us kind of connect us to the tech community? You know, tell us some of the things we don't know. To his credit, he's good at surrounding himself with people who know things that he doesn't. So he knows he's not a tech guy, but he brings people around him who do get it. So yeah, it was an incredible experience. I got to be a tech advisor, a media surrogate, and really provide them some strategy and guidance. I'll actually be with him tomorrow morning. That's one of the reasons I'm flying out tonight. Yeah, it was incredible to be involved in something like that. You know, no matter where you are at politically, to be that close to the democratic process, it really was special to me. And I hope to continue to be involved because I do think that those of us with skills that could provide value at a bigger scale, we should share that to try and make the country a better place. Because I know, having kind of been involved the last year or so, there's a lot of people in a lot of places of power who don't know what they're doing. And I think, you know, the last 15 years of the U.S. starts to show that. So yeah, it was a great experience. And now I help some good politicians with tech and things of that sort.
Now, you've mentioned Y Combinator a couple times, and I believe they helped you get access to ChatGPT. How did that change things?
Yeah, so a lot of what we do in construction, it's replacing inefficient, manual, paper-laden processes. And traditional software, you can do automation and whatnot. You can only go as far as like your scripting can go. Like, you have to write everything. You have to tell the software because the software knows nothing. Whereas with the advent of large language models like OpenAI and ChatGPT, their chatbot, these things can now, I don't want to say reason, but essentially figure things out and do it themselves. Once a large language model understands what you're doing, for your customer, for example, it can pretty much do that itself once it's trained. And so what it allowed us to do was scale our back end, scale our processes on the company side to take on a lot more customers. It really took us to the next level. So because we're a Y Combinator company, Sam Altman, who's the founder and CEO of OpenAI, was also Y Combinator. He was a former partner at YC. So because of that, we got some of the earliest access to ChatGPT, like a year ago when everyone was like, oh my God, like when only the tech nerds were like, what the heck? How is this possible? We realized right away it could really accelerate our growth. But not only that, Bill Gates made a comment when that came out, and he's right. Large language models and what AI is becoming, it's not just a new tech that's cool. It's going to fundamentally change the way business is run. Because if you have AI that can do the things that 10 people can do, and that company is still, you know, inefficient to the tune of 10 people doing it manually, you're never going to keep up with AI. So AI is now a type of company builder. And we realized that too. So we wanted to be one of the first in there. Not only, again, just from an operational perspective, it's made us that much more lightweight, that much more efficient, but it also got us a lot of good press. Again, Fox Business did a segment on us because of it. So yeah, I mean, AI and large language models are really going to change the world. And it's one of the reasons we're the leader in supply chain and building materials and construction, because it just allows us to do so many things that couldn't be done or couldn't be done as efficiently before.
What would you say to folks that are kind of scared of AI or scared of it replacing people?
Yeah. So, I mean, like any new technology, you have these fears. Every single one. I mean, you can go back to the internet when, you know, some folks used to say, I'm never going to put my credit card on the internet. And now cash barely even exists. You know, your whole life financially is on the internet. The other thing is AI is not there yet. There's still a lot of like Oracle problem, meaning like AI still has trouble grabbing things from outside of its own kind of radius, like dealing with a vendor, for example, things like that. So it's not there yet. I see AI, and we say this for DigiBuild, we use AI to empower, not replace. And I think in many cases, AI will empower, not replace. People might be scared of it. And unfortunately, so much of this is government driven, because there's always a government narrative, because the government wants to control something before everyone else does. So they fear monger around it. But think about the things, the opposite of that spectrum. I mean, it's going to detect cancer years before any doctor could with human eyes. It's going to stop, you know, national disasters years before any geologist could, understanding, you know, the movement of the tectonic plates or something like that. It's going to, again, make, you know, construction. We are the second largest market in the world. We contribute to about 13% of global GDP. If we can make that as an industry 5% more efficient, we're talking massive gains financially for society, more houses that can be built, even, you know, things like for the atmosphere and for green building. AI can say, hey, you can get all the same benefits that you wanted, but use this material and it's all carbon neutral, right? Or something along those lines. So what is important to remember is AI is going to do so much more to help humanity than it is going to hurt. The problem is the government wants to govern, unfortunately. And the elites sometimes think that they should be the ones controlling this stuff. And I think it needs to be open source, or there needs to be, the market needs to have an opportunity at this.
What's on the roadmap for DigiBuild now?
Really expansion. So we obviously have really big customers. There's still a lot of big companies here in the US who, you know, we haven't gotten to yet, who we will. Really continuing to refine kind of our main product offerings, which is where we help companies buy their material at a better price. We help keep those jobs on schedule, like I mentioned. We help to automate some of the paper-laden, annoying processes they have to do. One of the big things that we're getting into now is data and data analytics. You know, we're becoming the single source of truth for anything like building material and supply commodity. So there's a lot we're going to be able to do with that for like real estate developers and people who are buying material and things like that. We are in the process of expanding to Saudi Arabia. So we have a couple $1 billion malls going up in Saudi Arabia right now, which is very interesting if you look at separate discussion, but the economies, you know, here in the US, you can't build anything, you know, commercial real estate, and like that is in a tough spot. In Saudi Arabia, they're building malls, $1 billion malls. I didn't even know those existed anymore. So just a interesting comparison of what's happening there versus here. We're in a growth phase, you know, continuing to become the trusted solution for supply chain.
When you do tear yourself away from keyboard, what are you doing for fun?
I enjoy sports. I like going to the gym. That's kind of my once a day thing. Like that time is blocked off from like 6 to 7:15 usually. I'll do that. I like to golf. I love to learn. Like, it's funny, I think you asked me this before we were chatting casually, like, what do you do in your time off? And like, the first thing I think of is learn. Like, what can I read? What can I, you know, find some new piece of information or knowledge that I don't have? It's just fun to me. I've always have been kind of nerdy like that. Yeah, I like building things. I like building things for people around me. I like helping people. As you could tell, I like talking.
No more time for online poker.
Yeah, so I've thought about it here and there, right? Now that there's so many more options, but the difference is, like, the way I think about it is, if I'm going to spend 10 hours, it'll take 10 hours to win a tournament, right? Like, unless that tournament's like $1 million, it's not worth my bandwidth. Like, think about what I can do, the way I think about it, with 10 hours of my bandwidth in my company or making investments. Or like, what if I get like 15th place in the tournament? So I spend 7 hours doing it just to make like $50. So no, every time I open my computer and think about playing online poker again, I'm like, oh, but I just read this. I can build this, or I could do this. So in the casino, when I get to a casino, like if I'm in Vegas or something, I'll sit down for a little bit. I have the itch, but just not like my passion is elsewhere these days.
What game would you sit at live? Like a 2-5, 5-10? Like,
I would probably only be comfortable. I mean, there's a lot of good players in 2-5 and 5-10. I would probably do like 1-2. Honestly, I would sit in like a multi-table tournament like in Vegas. So maybe my comeback will be the World Series of Poker next year. And in my mind, I'm final table at the main event in my first comeback event. And then I wake up.
Well, to push one more poker analogy, we talked on the pre-call about the continuation bet. For folks that don't play poker in Texas Hold'em, there's a round of betting before the shared cards in the middle are seen, the flop. And usually the person that was most aggressive before seeing the flop will make a bet whether or not those shared cards improved his or her hand or not. You mentioned that there was a time when you sent 2,000 LinkedIn messages just, hey, I'm going to make this continuation bet and see what comes of it. What happened with that?
It worked out in many cases, or actually, it probably worked out in 10% of cases. 90% of cases, no one even responded to me, but I think that's the lesson in it. So what? Because the 10% that did respond to me provided so much value that it was worth it. And I think so many people are afraid to just like shoot their shot, for lack of a better term. You know, there's nothing wrong with someone telling you, no, it's not going to hurt you. Send that cold message. One day when I'm a billionaire, there's going to be all these people who laugh because they have a cold message from me from 2018 asking for $100,000 that they never responded to, right? And even now, like, I'll get LinkedIn messages from people who didn't respond to me 4 years ago. And they're like, hey, are you raising any money? I'd love an opportunity to talk about it. So like, I just really think so many people are scared to try. And if you fail, so what? You're better. If you're wrong, so what? You're better because next time you're not going to be wrong. You have that information.
You learned something.
Yeah. So one specific area or one example where I really did that, this was when DigiBuild was still my side hustle. And I was working one night watching Netflix. And on Netflix, there's a show called Dirty Money. And on Dirty Money, there was an episode about Trump. And so I'm like, whatever, I'll just put it on, like, you know, just cycling through shows as I'm working. And I see this gal on there, and her name is Barbara Rez, and I see her title is Trump's VP of Construction from, like, I don't know, the 80s to 90s or 2000, whatever. I was like, wow, like, that person would be really good if I could talk to them. So literally, as I watched Netflix, I just went to LinkedIn and looked her up and sent her a cold message. Fast forward to where we're at now, she helped me build my software. I mean, she's a friend of mine. I learned so much from her, and it all started from sending a cold message that 99% of people would be like, nah, she's not going to respond to me. And she did. And that's an example of what a low effort thing, just being willing to kind of take that step, can do. Yeah. I mean, at some point, kind of like poker, sometimes you just have to fire a bet. Like, even if, like, whether it's a C bet, knowing that, like, you missed the flop and you have to keep going now, or whether it's, you know, the right time to do it, just do it. I try to approach my life with that. Worst case scenario, you learn something for next time. Best case scenario, you get something that can benefit you or your purpose or whatever it is you're working on.
Well, I think your poker education did set you up well for the business world.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Rob, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Yeah, thank you, Andrew. Incredible what you do. Happy to be here. Happy to do it again sometime.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.